This is October 16th, 2016, and it's the day after our part two of our 50th anniversary commemoration, in which we were treated to a superb talk on meditation by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's with us here in the Zendo this morning. Let me just, on behalf of the Sangha and probably many others in town, thank him formally for making such a tremendous contribution, including donating everything, all the proceeds, the gate receipts to the center to help us defray the enormous expenses we had at part one in July, the reunion of Sangha. Former and present Sangha members. This being mid-October, with Thanksgiving coming up next month, my mind turned toward the precepts, because we have our annual Jukai, or taking the precepts ceremony on Thanksgiving weekend. And most years, I find a way to do at least two, sometimes three, teishos about the precepts leading up to the ceremony in late November. I think there's only one teisho left between now and the day of the precept ceremony. So I want to touch on some features of the precepts. I've given so many teishos, maybe easily 20 teishos on the precepts. On the day of the ceremony itself, I'll still plan to do a review of, you know, kind of a light once over of the precepts. But in most of my teishos, I've taken one element, one component of these precepts, or another, or two, or three at once. I'm going to do the same today, starting with what we call in Buddhism the three essentials of Buddhism. That's the translation I most often run across. There are other ones. It's sort of the three pillars of Buddhist practice and teaching. And these three are sila, to use the original Sanskrit sila, which means morality, meditation or dhyana, and wisdom or prajna. Some of you have heard me address these three things. The longer I practice the Dharma, the more I see how profoundly important these three are, like the three legs of a three-legged stool. You take away one, and the stool collapses. If you ignore either morality, upright conduct, or meditation, or prajna, then wisdom, then it's not a complete practice, and at worst, it means a collapse, the discontinuation of practice. So I'm going to first talk about the relationship between these three, and then go on and take one of the 10 cardinal precepts. Morality, meditation, and wisdom. These three are all together, mutually conditioning and mutually supportive, just like three legs of a stool. So let's start off. Let's just pick one. Let's start off with meditation or dhyana. Dr. Kabat-Zinn gave such a full and rich and complete presentation about this in particular meditation last night that I have very little that I would add to it, except a bit about the particular quality of koan meditation. But first, more generally, I agree that another word we could use for meditation is awareness. Awareness both while we're sitting and while we're not sitting. While we're sitting on the mat or the chair and when we're not. I've said so often that if you think of Zen practice as limited to sitting, then you have no understanding about what we're doing here. We have to extend this mind of stabilized awareness that we have while sitting, or we try to have while sitting, to extend that into everything, every waking moment of our lives, our daily lives, everything. The challenge, though, the reason why in Zen perhaps we single out sitting meditation so much is because without the sitting, the moving meditation, that is, the moving awareness or mindfulness, becomes much more difficult. Theoretically, there's no difference. I mean, in essence, there is no difference, not just theoretically. In essence, there is no difference between what we're trying to do on the mat and what we're trying to do off the mat. It's to maintain awareness. But practically, in practical terms, good luck on doing that off the mat if you don't sit every day. And this is where we place such a high priority on the sitting, though not, of course, at the expense of the moving meditation or awareness. So let's just take two of the three, meditation or awareness. Let's just for the moment make it awareness. We all know we're talking about meditation in the broad sense. I would point out that there are perhaps two general kinds of awareness. There is the awareness of phenomena, mental and physical phenomena, and the absence of phenomena, say silence, for example, although you could call silence a phenomenon also. This is, I think, where the word mindfulness really fits perfectly. Part of the problem of getting into this realm of practice is that some of these words can be understood in different ways. And so there are some semantic liberties that we have to, or choices we have to make in using the word. So I'm just going to just present one way of looking at this. So the mindfulness of the mental and physical phenomena and the phenomena all around us, our environment, and mindfulness of what is the space that is within sounds and feelings and emotions and thoughts and so forth. This can be understood, this mindfulness, this type of mindfulness, can be understood as the seventh of the Noble Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path is the formula that's usually offered for what the Buddha realized as far as practice and realization. So the Four Noble Truths: the pervasiveness of suffering, the cause of suffering, that there is a way out of suffering, and then number four is the Noble Eightfold Path, which most commonly those eight approaches or eight angles of practice are, I think, most commonly translated as, just very quickly, right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right effort, right livelihood, right mindfulness, and right concentration. 7 and 8, right mindfulness and right concentration. Let's focus on number 8, right concentration. This, I think most often, we in Zen we refer to as no-mindedness, as compared to mindfulness. No-mindedness, I think a similar phrase would be concentration. Yeah, right mindfulness, right concentration. And this may be a different kind of awareness. There's that other awareness we mentioned of phenomena and the absence of phenomena, of silence. And then there is awareness of the true nature of phenomena, of the true nature of things, or the way things are. The Japanese word kensho, I think, is most often translated as seeing into the nature of things, awakening to the nature of things. And maybe we could say that this second kind of awareness, this no-minded awareness of the nature of things, is awareness of that which is beyond phenomena, beyond both phenomena and non-phenomena. This is the awareness that form is only emptiness, emptiness only form, as we say in the Heart Sutra. So an awareness of our essential nature. Koans were devised in China about 1,000 years ago as a way to accelerate this second kind of awareness, the awareness of the true nature of things, awakening. Especially a first koan. The idea, it seems, was that if you take a koan like what is mu, or what is it, more broadly, what is it, what is this, or even who am I, what am I, these very simple, short, fundamental questions of existence or the nature of things, if investigated single-mindedly, which leads to no-minded absorption, that these can reveal the true nature of things. My mind always goes to this one of the Chinese masters. I don't think it was ever attributed to one in particular. It was quoted by another later Chinese master, but who said, "One who is working on mu does not see the sky when he raises his eyes, nor the ground when he lowers his eyes." Now that is not what we usually mean by mindfulness. Does not see the sky above or the ground below. And so people understandably ask, well, what's this got to do with mindfulness and the enormous importance of mindfulness in our daily life? Well, as I understand it, it's understood as a temporary state. It's something that in the deepest kinds of absorption can happen, where we lose awareness of everything around us. And it's never, ever would be seen as any point of arrival. The point of reaching that depth of losing oneself, and losing oneself really always means losing one's environment, losing that mindful awareness, the point is to break through that state of darkness in order to see into the true nature of things, and by virtue of that experience, that awakening experience, to then become more aware and mindful in one's daily life in every kind of way. There is a danger, though, with this no-minded absorption. There's just a practical danger. If you're so deeply absorbed in a samadhi of questioning mu, or questioning one's true self, inquiring into the nature of things, this could be just hazardous. I think somewhere I have vague memories of stories of people, if not walking out into traffic, some other kind of hazardous thing. I don't know. Maybe I'm just remembering what I imagine could happen. And so in Sesshin, where I would say that no-mindedness is emphasized even over mindfulness. In Sesshin, we have these monitors who are assigned to monitor people who may have become so absorbed that they're losing track of where they're supposed to be, or they're losing track of time. This is another not quite as dangerous feature of no-mindedness. Is just you become so absorbed in what you're doing that time disappears. This is really a little taste of the eternal, because time is a human construct. Minutes and hours and months and years and seconds, these are all constructed by human beings through our bifurcating minds, our discriminating minds. And when that mind, that discriminating mind, is silenced, when it's just swallowed up in single-minded absorption, then we're free of time. That's one of the exhilarating things about reaching a samadhi, is time is gone. With time gone, there's no pressure, to pick up on a thread that Jon Kabat-Zinn used in his talk last night. When you're fully, fully present, then everything else disappears. But we can't live this way in our daily lives of coming and going. We have to be aware of our schedules, our appointments, and many other things. But to have the ability, when we don't have to be concerned about time or space, to have the ability to just lose ourselves while we're washing dishes or playing with our children, when time is of no concern, to be able to drop it, is just a wonderful kind of freedom. But even here, the greater danger, besides just hazard, I mean, this state, by the way, this state of not seeing the sky when you raise your head or the ground when you lower it, is an exceedingly rare state, and if it happens at all, it's most likely to happen in the very rarefied conditions of a retreat, such as a sesshin. But there is something that can be described as no-mindedness, but is something dysfunctional. I have a short article here someone sent me from the Boston Globe in April of this year. The title is "Trump Exists Only in the Now." And he says, Donald Trump is the only American capable of living completely in the present. Not present in the psychotherapeutic sense of mindfulness. That's the important distinction. But the actual temporal, chronological present. The moment that exists literally, momentarily, and disappears. The fleeting now. The space where any serious consideration of the past or the future is completely immaterial. Trump fascinates and attracts... Now, be sure, I am not saying you shouldn't vote for Trump. That would put us, our tax-exempt status at risk. It's just a clinical observation by this Michael Sokolow. Trump fascinates and attracts precisely because he is completely unburdened by the past and freed from concerns for the future. No amount of failure, either personal or professional, weighs upon him. He shows zero concern for verifiable history. His bankruptcies and divorces don't matter to him, so why should they matter to his supporters? He has zero guilt and even less shame. He doesn't flip-flop or waffle or reverse himself, because when you exist completely in the present, as he does, nothing occurring previously holds any consequence. Being untethered from linear time allows Trump to deny reality with impunity. His audacity completely disarmed both his rivals and the media, and so forth. So, and this isn't just one or particular two people. This is a kind of a real serious affliction where I would call it a denial of, a lack of awareness, maybe even, but a denial of past and future. Aroshi Kaplow, I think in The Three Pillars of Zen, one of his books, talks about a question that came up with his first teacher in Japan, Harada Roshi, Harada Sogaku Roshi, where a person thought about this danger and said, wouldn't, if we're completely in the now, wouldn't this put us at risk of just ignoring all moral considerations, all any kind of consequences our behavior might have on others? And then what Harada Roshi evidently did was he drew on a chalkboard. Remember chalkboards? He drew on a chalkboard two lines, a vertical line intersecting with a horizontal line. And he said, if the vertical line, he was a math professor, among other things, as well as a philosophy professor, if the vertical line represents time and the horizontal line represents space, then each one of us is at that intersection, that dot, but we're not disconnected from time before and after and here and there. The danger of this kind of diseased living only in the now type of presence is that you're divorced, we're disconnected from those two lines, and we're just that little dot in the center. Back to meditation, morality, and wisdom. Let's look at how intimately connected they are. Meditation fortifies and purifies upright conduct, moral conduct, in a couple of ways. First, by enable us to be mindful of the consequences that could occur as a result of not just our actions, but our words and even our thoughts. That's a mindfulness of the future and causation. Very important that by doing meditation we have this awareness of our responsibility to others. It also, mindfulness reveals the interdependence. Eventually, if sooner or later, if we do it long enough, we'll become aware of the interdependence of all beings, and that itself strengthens our priority we place in upright conduct. But then it also, meditation or awareness, let's say, as this other kind of awareness, awakening to the true nature of things, awakening to the truth of no self, of no self another, this also fortifies our upright conduct, or theoretically it does, once we see, because so much of bad behavior is wrapped around self-interest, if to the degree that we see through the self, see the illusory nature of the self, to that degree, and there are many degrees that that can happen, to that degree we are will be less inclined to act purely out of self-centered motives. So why, then, do even Zen teachers and Tibetan Buddhist teachers get caught in these scandals of unwholesome conduct? I've been asking myself that for decades. How can that happen? And the only thing I can understand is that there is some deep characterological deficits that existed before practice, and that short of full enlightenment, I suppose, I don't know, but short of full enlightenment, some of these deeply ingrained characterological issues will remain in place. That's the only explanation I have for it. Other than just this sort of cerebral rationalization, when you're cozying up to someone, to a student, or someone who's not your wife, that you somehow tell yourself that, okay, there's only now, that all moral systems fundamentally are empty. Which is true, but then misusing that understanding, probably because of these characterological issues. But for, in most cases, people who don't have these deep afflictions, we're going to find it easier to live in accordance with the precepts by doing meditation on a daily basis, both on the mat and off the mat, practicing awareness. It's always this danger. People hear meditation, at least in Zen, and you think of just sitting in a cross-legged posture. So, meditation or awareness helps with morality. It also has the promise of eventually revealing prajna wisdom, or leading to prajna wisdom, which is the realization of our essential nature. There are cases, exceedingly rare cases, of people who seem to actually have come to enlightenment without daily meditation, but that's so rare that we should just dismiss it from our minds as an option. Okay, that's the value of meditation. Then the second one, I say second, these can be mixed up in any order, but morality. Morality, or upright conduct, supports meditation. How? Well, this is a very practical way. By if we're not hurting other people. And that's what the precepts come down to. There's just a kind of a formula of how to avoid causing harm, or causing as little as possible. If we can live that way, then we're likely to be able to maintain our awareness more continuously. If we've done things to hurt others, meaning transgressing against one or more of these precepts, then we're more likely, if we have a conscience, to bring that with us, carry that with us in our efforts of sitting and moving meditation. It can make a big difference. With lying, for example, manual laborer, someone told me about, I think John Pauline, said, I like telling the truth because I like traveling light. That lightness can become part of our sitting and moving meditation if we uphold not only the precept on not lying, but also the others. The Buddha said, great becomes the fruit, great the advantages of meditation when it is set round with upright conduct. And then morality, also supporting wisdom. They go together by upholding the precepts, and which means really functioning out of our Buddha nature. That's in Zen we say that's what the precepts are really describing, is a full Buddha in the purest sense. The more we can live our lives in accordance with the precepts, the more likely, well, first of all, the more likely we're going to be able to buy the teaching that we are all intrinsically enlightened. We all have this illumined mind. And that becomes a mat then that by bolstering faith, we're more likely then to realize, to confirm through direct experience, our own Buddha nature. And the Buddha also said, the next sentence, he said, great becomes the fruit, great becomes the advantages of wisdom when it is set round with meditation. And then the third one, wisdom, prajna wisdom, that's understood in some streams of Buddhism as knowledge, learning, studying the sutras and the texts. But here we're talking about prajna wisdom, that is the direct experience of reality, awakening. And this purifies and deepens our meditation by having revealed the illusory nature of self and other. Because the self, this notion, it's an idea, because the notion of a self is such a strong obstruction, the primary obstruction in meditation, awareness, once we've seen through that to some degree, to that degree, our sitting and our moving meditation will be that much better. And wisdom reinforces upright morality for the same reason. Once we've seen into the illusory nature of self, then we're less likely to be grasping and imagining that we can get something for nothing, we can get away with anything. Now, I'm just going to take one of the 16 precepts, one of the 10 cardinal precepts, which is number 3, not to misuse sexuality. And this sprang to my mind because of the big splash last week about in the presidential campaign of the women who are courageously coming forward and reporting that they had been preyed upon or abused sexually by, in minor or less minor ways, by Trump. It's an old story, if it's true. We wouldn't know if it's true, of course. He may be a choir boy, for all we know. But we've gone through this with so many others. Men in position of power, our own Elliot Spitzer and his involvement with prostitutes, and Tiger Woods and Arnold Schwarzenegger and John Edwards and Dominique Strauss, whatever, and Bill Clinton for sure, and others. And many people have said that alpha males, that is, those who acquire power, rise to positions of power, are sort of disposed to have trouble in controlling their impulses. I have an old article that came in on the heels of this scandal with Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the French politician. We won't need to go into anything about what he did, but that's one of the many. There is this idea that if you are taking advantage of women that way, then this is because you're an alpha male, this is an idea of masculinity. And then in this article by Sarah Lipton, with no date on it, it says, this conception of masculinity is relatively new, however. For most of Western history, the primary and most valued characteristic of manhood was self-mastery. Late antique and Roman writers, like Plutarch, lauded men for their ability to resist sexual temptation and control bodily desire through force of will and intellect. Too much sex was thought to weaken men. Rampant sexuality was something men were supposed to grow out of. In medieval political theory, young male bodies were used as symbols of badly run kingdoms. A man who indulged in excessive eating, drinking, sleeping, or sex, that is, who failed to, quote, rule himself, was considered unfit to rule, there's that word, unfit to rule his household, much less a polity. And then it says that far from seeming manly, in these earlier centuries, aggressive sexuality was associated with women. Glad we're past that, or largely past it. And then he says, Sarah Lipton says, how and why have we moved so far from this ideal of real men, real virility being associated with self-control or self-restraint? She asks, why do so many powerful men take sexual risks that destroy their families and careers? Contemporary worship of youth is one explanation. I think this is very spot on for contemporary mores. The worship of youth. Rather than shunning the idea of childishness, many adults, male and female, now spend much of their time clinging to an illusory and endless adolescence. Now, I don't know if you have anyone comes to mind that you hear this, but the ability to be a player, in quotations, well into middle age, thus becomes a point of pride rather than shame for the modern man. Perhaps the erosion of men's exclusive status as breadwinners and heads of households also figures in. When one no longer, quote, rules the household, there may be less motivation for or satisfaction in ruling oneself. I think this is very insightful. Another article, this one from 2011, New York Times, Sunday Magazine, or Week in Review, The Sexist Pig Myth. And she poses, Benedict Carey, poses the question, if I had all their power, how would I behave? And he says, sure, becoming a big shot, like a billionaire, for example, can bring out a guy's inner Boy Scout, his gentleman philanthropist, and even in later years, his bushy-browed wise man. But the headlines are a relentless reminder, remember this is 5 years ago, of how often success seems to breed serial philanderers, groping boors, and worse, sexual deviants. Does power turn regular guys into sexual predators? The answer in most cases is no, say social scientists and therapists who have long experience working with men. Power is a facilitator, said one author of a book called Men and Sex. It provides opportunities to men with certain appetites, but seldom changes personality in any fundamental way. He says only a minority of men feel entitled to have their way, to dominate others, to humiliate them. Who could that be? If provoked. These guys usually know who they are, and the people around them sure do. They were grabbing waitresses or pulling the wings off flies well before becoming chairman of the board. 5 years ago, so don't think I'm pointing to anyone now. People are debating now whether some cultures even sanction this behavior. Yet, if social science is any guide, arrogance generally precedes power, not the other way around. For all their professed suspicion of autocrats, people tend to cede authority precisely to those individuals who want it most. I came to the tentative conclusion of 10 or 15 years ago that anyone who has an appetite for power so all-consuming that they can endure a year and a half of an presidential election campaign as a candidate isn't fit to be president. But we only have so many choices. Studies of group behavior suggest that the overconfident, outspoken individuals are the ones who tend to become the leaders, and the experience of being at the top only reinforces the person's sense of control and self-centeredness. In one recent study, researchers primed participants to feel powerful by having them write about an incident in which they had control over others and then distribute lottery tickets to themselves and another study subject. These high-powered, in quotes, people were significantly less accurate in reading emotions from facial photographs than a comparison group of participants who were not primed in the same way. This and other experiments suggest that power can blind people to the emotions of those around them and lead to, quote, objectifying others in a self-interested way, the authors concluded. If the person, this is the one of the researchers, if the person has this sense of superiority and they've gotten away with these kinds of things before, they begin to think that the risk-reward ratio that applies to everyone else doesn't apply to them because they're so special. It's hard for people who don't think that way about themselves to believe that anyone else really does, but they do. And then one other paragraph. These and other similar findings seem only mildly surprising until placed in a larger context. For most of human history, men have treated women much as they pleased, and powerful men routinely collected wives and lovers, feeling free to maim or kill those who offended. The social norms, criminal laws, and progressive culture of the West evolved in part to check such abuses, and most men not only observe those rules, but also, as its attitude surveys show, internalize them. Well, not all men. I think it's a potential, is a great big silver lining to the dark cloud of charges against one of the presidential candidates. For all of this juvenile manhandling of women at his pleasure, that it's bringing to the surface what is now many are recognizing has been a continuing problem for women forever. It's really raising our consciousness of what so many women have to suffer because of a lack of power, especially vis-a-vis men of great power and wealth. So we're just embarking now. This is such fresh territory recently that we're just embarking on what could prove to be a very fruitful and healing discussion and change in our country. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attend.